chapter 1, verse 12 onwards. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I'll chant the verse first. Tasya Sanjanayan Harsham. Tasya Sanjanayan Harsham. Kuru Vriddha Pitamaha. Kuru Vriddha Pitamaha. Simmanadam Vinadyochai. Shankham Dadmau Pratapavan. Tasya Sanjanayan Harsham. Kuru Vriddha Pitamaha. Simmanadam Vinadyochai. Shankham Dadmau Pratapavan. Very loudly. Befitting his position as a lion, indirectly, by the symbolism of the conch shell, he informed his depressed grandson Duryodhan that he had no chance of victory in the battle because the Supreme Lord Krishna was on the other side. But still, it was his duty to conduct the fight and no pains would be spared in that connection. So we'll stop here and we'll discuss this verse, and as time goes by we can go to the next verses so that we can cover till text 19 today. What I can do is I can at least go through the translations right now and then we can discuss it further. So text 13 translation. After that, the conch shells, after that is after blowing of the conch shell by Bhishma Dev. After that, the conch shells, drums, bugles, trumpets and horns were all suddenly sounded. And the combined sound was tumultuous. Text number 14, translation. On the other side, both Lord Krishna and Arjun, stationed on a great chariot drawn by white horses, sounded their transcendental conch shells. Text number 15, translation. Lord Krishna blew his conch shell called Panchajanya. Arjun blew his, the Devadatta, and Bhim, the voracious eater and performer of Herculean tasks, blew his terrific conch shell called Paundra. Text 16 to 18, translation. King Yudhishthir, the son of Kunti, blew his conch shell, the Ananta Vijaya, and Nakul and Sahadev blew the Sughosha and Mani Pushpak. The great archer, the king of Kashi, the great fighter Shikhandi, Drishtadyumna, Virata, the unconquerable Satyaki, Drupad, the sons of Draupadi, and others, O king, such as the mighty armed son of Subhadra, all blew their respective conch shells. Text number 19, translation. The blowing of these different conch shells became uproarious, vibrating both in the sky and on the earth. It shattered the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra. Om Agyanati Mirandhasa Gyananjana Shalaka Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Hare Krishna. So I welcome all the devotees to our weekly class, daily class on the Bhagavad Gita. We just started day before yesterday and many devotees are making their sincere and honest attempt to discuss Bhagavad Gita. Let's see how we go today. Yesterday, I believe, the speaker, Gopinachandra Prabhu, he discussed from text number 2 to text number 11. And if you try to arrive at some kind of a gist of these verses, then it speaks about the diplomacy that is there in Duryodhan's heart, which comes out in the form of words. He tries to agitate Bhishma Dev, he tries to agitate the other people, speaks very diplomatically. Of course, he is a Kshatriya, administrative person, so he has to speak diplomatically. But then the way in which it is expressed, you know, you can actually make it out. And, you know, he's trying to use double-sworded words. Like that. Today, in text number 12, it starts off with Bhishma Dev's reaction. So before, for around 10 verses, we have Duryodhan speaking diplomatically. And in response to that, what does Bhishma Dev do? Bhishmadev is a man of action. Bhishmadev is a senior. In this verse especially, he is addressed as Kuru Vruddha. He is addressed as Kuru Vruddha. Vruddha, we all know, is an old man. It could also mean a person with lot of experience, with lot of maturity. So Kuru Vruddha means, as Prabhupada translates, he is the great grandsire of the Kuru dynasty. Very mature person. So when a child is acting childishly, does a mature person also act childishly? No. His response is an expression of his maturity. So for 10 verses, Duryodhan is just speaking big words, trying to agitate different people and trying to make Bhishmadev, you know, realize his position that actually you are favorable to the Pandavas, but then you are on our side. So I am going to watch over you. How are you going to fight? But Bhishmadev responds not with words. He acts like a mature person. He blows the conch shell. In the Vedic civilization, especially during wars, what does the conch shell represent? It represents the start of a war. Unlike today's wars, in which there is no moment at which the war starts, and you know there's no time at which the war ends, the Vedic wars were not fought like that. The Vedic wars, the two armies, the two sides who are fighting with each other, they assemble on the battlefield, and at a hour that is decided, especially close to the sunrise, the two parties will sound their conch shells, signaling that now the war will start. And at the time near sunset, they'll again blow their conch shells, which indicates to both the parties that now the war has ended for the day. After a conch shell is sounded in the evening, even if the opposite party comes to your tent, as has happened many times during the Mahabharata war, Krishna went to Karna during the war. So war is going on. During the day, when you are fighting with that person, you are bloodthirsty for him. You are about to kill him. But in the evening, when the same person, after the conch shell has been sounded to indicate the end of the war for that day, the same person comes to you, you treat him like a royal guest. But this shows, you know, how Vedic culture was very sophisticated. It was very advanced. That yes, you fight a war, but then war is fought between certain hours. Today especially, you know, modern warfare is fought especially at night. That's why during wars, you know, you have to shut off lights. All the cities, they are blacked out. Because planes hovering above, they should not know where is the city. If they see a, you know, thick pocket of lights, as is there in the cities, then they'll bomb especially the city at night. You also are aware of, you know, night vision goggles. Why are night vision goggles required? Because soldiers today are instructed to fight at night. That's the time when the other party is sleeping or taking rest or, you know, recuperating because of the wounds that were inflicted during the day. But Vedic wars are very civilized. Vedic wars are fought by clearly indicating to the opposite party, now I am going to fight with you, so be ready. And the other party also responds by blowing his conch shell that yes, I am ready. And when they are, you know, ready to end, they actually follow that. So this is something that we could see, that Bhishmadev's sign of maturity is, he does not respond with words to the words of Duryodhan. Of course, Duryodhan's words were empty. They did not have any substance. And Bhishmadev could have responded with some of his words, some of his wisdom, some of his experience. But he chose to blow his conch shell and signal to Duryodhan, don't worry, you are accusing me of being biased towards the Pandavas, but don't worry, see, I am the first person who is starting the war. The Pandavas are not signaling the start of the war. I am the person who is blowing his conch shell. And this signals my dedication to you. This signals that irrespective of whether I love the Pandavas or not, because I am on your side, I am going to fight on your side. I am going to be loyal to you. This is something that we could understand. Kuru Vruddha, as I said, means a mature person, an old person. Something that we could also gain from this verse is, in today's modern warfare, the generals, the leaders of armies, where are they when wars are fought? When some countries had, you know, recently invaded Afghanistan, where were the war generals? Were they in Afghanistan? They were in their own country, far, far away, miles away from the actual war place. They are there in their own sophisticated, protected bunkers. which are bomb-proof, of course, bullet-proof, and so many other things proof. And they are monitoring the situation by satellites. And they'll instruct their soldiers, they'll instruct their people, subordinates, by radio, by telephone, and like that. Shows how fearful they are of the actual situation. If a war general has to show his strength, has to show his valor, he has to be right there on the battlefield fighting. One of the few things that are mentioned that especially attracted devotees to Srila Prabhupada was that Srila Prabhupada himself would be so eager for preaching. We don't hear of devotees who would assemble near Prabhupada and Prabhupada would instruct them, you should preach like this, you should preach like this, and you should sing like this, and this way we'll propagate the Krishna consciousness movement. No. Of course, he would instruct during the classes. But if you see the daily lifestyle of Prabhupada, he was out there fighting with Maya and leading his soldiers in their fight to Maya, with Maya. In the morning, he would get up early, translate his books. He would take darshan, go for a morning walk to keep his health nice. Then, you know, many times there are instances. Many times there are instances where Prabhupada would go from, travel from one country to another country. He would land at the airport. And right at the airport, there is a press conference. Devotees, you know, they are so eager that Prabhupada help them with that local preaching. They would arrange a press conference right there. Sometimes, you know, right from the airport, he would be taken to some engagement where he would speak. So, whole day he is busy. He would rarely get some rest. So, he was busy preaching himself, and that's why he is called an Acharya. Acharya is a person who teaches by his achar, by his own behavior, by his own practices. And that's why you see, although the followers of Prabhupada did not get much of his association, in the sense he was there in the West only for 10 years or so, but during that time, because they saw the personal example of Prabhupada, how eager he was for preaching, how eager he was to dispel the illusion in the present in the minds of the common masses, today, even after his physical disappearance, all his followers are so fired up in continuing his mission. Why? Because they saw their war general right with them, ahead of them, fighting the war along with them, even though he was very old. Here also, Bhishma Dev, very old, Kuru Vruddha. But he is there right on the battlefield fighting. He is not in his palace communicating with the help of some communication system. Now you advance, now you advance. No, he is there. He is out there fighting. So this also shows how the Vedic culture is more of a culture of practice, not more of words. It's more of action, not of complacency. Many times in modern scenario, when we are preaching, many people may accuse us that your Vedic culture, we know, you know, it's more of like chant Hare Krishna always. Just you people are devotees, just sit in your rooms and chant Hare Krishna, not of action. But if you see different examples from Bhagavatam, different examples from the Shastras, it's a culture of action, but not action that is misdirected, that is directed and guided by elderly people, by mature people, and leaded or led by mature people. In this case, we have Bhishma Dev, who is leading the whole army and is addressed as Kuru Vruddha. One of the characteristics of Kshatriyas mentioned in the 18th chapter is Yuddhecha Apapalayanam. He should not run away from the Yuddha. But here we see he is right there in front of everyone, ready to fight. This is one of the characteristics of Kshatriyas. So this is Vedic culture. Vedic culture is very sophisticated and it believes in teaching by example and less by words. In this verse, Prabhupada also mentions, indirectly, of course, he tried to cheer Duryodhan by sounding the conch shell, befitting his position as a lion. Then Prabhupada mentions, indirectly, by the symbolism of the conch shell, he informed his depressed grandson Duryodhan that he had no chance of victory in the battle because the Supreme Lord Krishna was on the other side. What is the symbolism of the conch shell? By blowing that conch shell, Prabhupada is saying, certainly he tried to cheer Duryodhan. But Prabhupada is saying he also used the symbolism of the conch shell to inform his depressed grandson that there is no chance for victory. Why? What is the symbolism of conch shell? I was trying to understand. So one thing that came to my mind was that Lord Narayan, Lord Krishna, Lord Vishnu,
he always has four, you know, there are four symbols: the conch, the lotus, the mace, gada, and the disc. And we all know that the disc and the mace are for non-devotees. Prabhupada mentions in one of the purports in Bhagavatam. So out of the four symbols, the two symbols, mace and the Sudarshan Chakra, the disc, are for non-devotees. And the lotus flower and the conch shell are for the devotees. So he's always ready. If some devotee comes, he's ready to bless them. If a non-devotee comes, he's ready to harm them, kill them. So that is what could come to my mind, that I didn't get any other reference to it. But by the symbolism of the conch, when it is said that Bhishma also wanted to tell the other party, Duryodhan, that you are not going to be victorious by Lord Krishna. But he's reminding, you know, see this conch shell? Whose symbol is the conch shell? Lord Vishnu's. And where is Lord Vishnu? He's on the other side. So don't think you are going to win. One another place in the Bhagavatam where this conch is used to bless the devotees is in the case of Dhruv Maharaj. Dhruv Maharaj was out there performing austerities as instructed by Narad Muni, his spiritual master. And he got the darshan of the Lord in his heart. He could see the Lord in his heart very quickly, of course. At one moment, it is described that the same Lord disappeared from his vision. In his heart, he was able to see the Lord, but he disappeared from his vision and appeared in front of him. Now just imagine, we chant Hare Krishna, we do different activities in our sadhana to have some darshan of the Lord. So many devotees on Sunday feast day, when they have a holiday, they come from other cities outside Bombay to take darshan of the Lord. That same very Lord appears right there in front of you. What do you do then? So Dhruv Maharaj, suddenly he saw the Lord in front of him. And his intelligence got bewildered. He could not compose himself. What to do now? How to offer prayers? He wanted to offer prayers. He's a devotee. He wanted to glorify the Lord. That is what devotees are eager to do. But then suddenly, you know, when the object of your desire for so long suddenly comes in front of you, don't know what to do. You get fumbled. So in this case, it is mentioned that Dhruv Maharaj also, he could not compose himself. And he was just standing there, hands folded, with a humble heart. Now what to do? And it is mentioned that Lord Vishnu, who came in front of him, Hiranyagarbha, he took his conch shell and touched his head with that conch shell, thus blessing him, thus giving him his mercy. And the verse goes like this: Satam vivakshantam tadvidam harir gyatvasya sarvasya chariti avasthita kritanjalim brahma mayena kambuna pasparsh balam kripaya kapole. So it mentions vivakshantam. Dhruv Maharaj was very eager to offer prayers, but atadvidam, he didn't know now what to offer, how to offer. He didn't know. Natadvidam, he didn't know. Gyatva asya, knowing this, sarvasya ridhi, the Lord who is situated in everyone's heart, he is also situated in Dhruv's heart. So he knew that, you know, he wants to offer me prayers, but somehow he is not able to compose himself. So what did he do? Brahma mayena kambuna. Kambu is a conch shell. So he touched that conch shell to his head, thus empowering him. Pasparsha, he made that sparsha. Balam, for that small child. Kripaya kapole, out of his causeless mercy, the Lord touched the conch shell to his head, and immediately Dhruv Maharaj got purified. In the next verse it is mentioned, at that time, three things happened. Dhruv Maharaj became perfectly aware of the Vedic conclusion and the absolute truth. His relationship with the other living entities, he also understood that. And then he offered deliberate and conclusive prayers to the Supreme Lord. Two words are used. Deliberate, it was not by chance. It was not that he just started speaking some gibberish. No. He started speaking the best deliberate prayers, and they were conclusive prayers. He did not speak some prayers that were characteristic of a neophyte devotee. A neophyte devotee also offers prayers, and a mature devotee also offers prayers. But when a mature devotee offers prayers, there is a lot of conclusion. Every sentence that we hear in Prabhupada's lecture or in some senior devotee's lecture, you know, every sentence can be meditated upon, is it not? But when a new devotee prays to the Lord, he is also praying. That is also in a positive mood. But then it may not be so dense. It may not be so much full of conclusions of devotional service. But, you know, 6 months of austerity, Lord appears, Lord touches the conch shell to his head, and he offers deliberate and conclusive prayers. So this is the symbolism of the conch shell that Bhishma Dev blew and indicated to Duryodhan, that my dear Duryodhan, you know, look at this conch shell, now you are not going to win this war, be aware of that.
The next line, Prabhupada mentions, but still, even though he is in one sense discouraging Duryodhan, that you are not going to win, but still, it was his duty of Bhishma Dev to conduct the fight, and no pains would be spared in that connection. So he is saying, Bhishma Dev would not make his own life comfortable. He is willing to suffer all pains. What is, in one sense, if you just see, analyze the life of Bhishma Dev, this person, how many times actually he experienced happiness, even from the mundane perspective. Prabhupada is saying, no pains would be spared during the course of this war. He will not compromise in any way. If that situation involves austerity for him, he's ready, he's willing to undergo that austerity. But if you see, his whole life is like that. Bhishma Dev's life, if you see, his whole life is like that. His father, he wanted to marry somebody. The father of that lady ordered him that, this person should not be there. This person should not be the next heir apparent. So he said, all right. Then he said, no, not only that, this person himself should not marry, because his son may even stake his claim to the throne. So Bhishma Dev, in his ripe young age, had to take a vow of brahmacharya, not marrying. He is such a person that, it was austerity right from his birth for him. His mother, Ganga Devi, she left him. Right? She left him at the early age. He never got association of his mother. When he becomes young, he cannot marry. He cannot have a normal married life, that of a Kshatriya. Especially Kshatriyas, they have married life. But he did not have that. In his personal life, it's not very pleasant. What about people who are dear to him? Pandu was very dear to him. Pandu left early. Kunti Maharani was dear to him. Kunti Maharani suffered widowhood, and during her whole life, she was seeing how her tender young sons, Pandavas, were being tormented, were being always given the ill treatment by the Kauravas. She always saw that. Bhishma Dev himself also, in a joint family, if the father is not there, the next senior person is in charge of the children. Is it not? In this family, Bhishma Dev was the next person in charge. So when Pandu disappeared, when he died, the charge of the Pandavas was with Bhishma Dev. The Kauravas had their father, but Pandavas were with him. And he could see how they were very pious, how they were very good-natured, and there was no contamination in them. Yet, bound as he was by his own vow that he'll always stay loyal to the throne of Hastinapur, he could not do anything about it. So if you see, his whole life, he has proved that in the matter of duty, my personal pleasure does not come in between. Whenever there is a choice of my own personal happiness or that of duty, I'll always go for the duty. So this is exemplified by Bhishma Dev. And because he led such a dutiful life, what was the result? The result was that at the end of his life, when he was lying on Shara Shaya, that is mentioned in the Bhagavatam, when he was lying on a bed of arrows, the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna himself brought the Pandavas to be instructed by him. Just some days back, before the start of the Mahabharata, Lord Krishna has instructed the supreme spiritual knowledge to Arjun in the form of Bhagavad Gita, the very same Bhagavad Gita that we are discussing. But after the war, Yudhishthir Maharaj starts developing some feelings, thinking that actually, I am the cause of suffering of so many people died, so many horses, so many elephants, so many living entities suffered during the war. So it was not good on my part. And he develops the feelings of remorse, contrition. That time it is mentioned that how come he is a pure devotee? Arjuna is a pure devotee. These Pandavas, throughout their life, they have taken shelter of Krishna. And Krishna is there with them. Before the start of the Mahabharata war, Bhagavad Gita was spoken, and the Pandavas agreed that, yes, this is right, to fight the war on your order is right. Yet at the end of the war, Yudhishthir Maharaj again develops, saintly person, he again develops this feelings that maybe what I did was wrong. Maybe I should not have caused this harm. So there it is mentioned in Bhagavatam that why did he develop these things? It is mentioned that Lord Krishna in the form of Paramatma is there in everyone's heart. So Lord Krishna is there in Yudhishthir Maharaj's heart also. So internally, externally, he convinced him. He was trying to tell him that no, what you did was right. This is a war not against the Pandavas and the Kauravas, but this is a war against dharma and adharma. So don't take it personally. But Lord Krishna, in the form of Paramatma, is in also the heart of Yudhishthira Maharaj. And in the form of Paramatma, he was guiding him that, yes, maybe you should feel remorse and now take instructions from Bhishma Dev. Because Bhishma Dev is his pure devotee, Lord Krishna's pure devotee. So in order to glorify Bhishma Dev, Lord Krishna from within the heart of Yudhishthira Maharaj guided him that now you go after the end of the war. Bhishma Dev is lying on a bed of arrows, just ready to leave. But because he has this benediction of Ichha Mrityu, he can leave whenever he wants. He's still there waiting for you and waiting to see that you are victorious in the battle. Because Bhishma Dev was injured before the end of the battle. So he could not know, in one sense, how the Pandavas were looking victorious in the battle. He always throughout his life wanted the Pandavas to be victorious. He always wanted them to sit on the throne. But he could not see it with his own eyes. So even after the war ended, Bhishma Dev did not leave his body. And so Lord Krishna at the end of the war brought all the Pandavas to Bhishma Dev so that Bhishma Dev could, with his very own eyes, could see all the Pandavas victorious and Yudhishthira Maharaj as the undisputed king of the whole world. And then Yudhishthira Maharaj poses questions to Bhishma Dev. How to carry out ruling, what are the various duties of the four classes, and then, you know, there's a long section, not in the Bhagavatam, but in Mahabharata, there is verses after verses in which Bhishma Dev, at the end of his life, instructs Yudhishthira Maharaj that how to carry out your duties now that you are the king. So Bhishma Dev, although his whole life, he was suffering pains because he always chose to perform his duty and not his personal pleasure. But at the end of his life, what did he get? He got to see the best thing that he desired. What did he desire? He desired that the pious Pandavas, the devotee Pandavas, should rule the planet. He got to see that. He is lying there on a bed of arrows. He is immovable. But Lord Krishna himself comes to him to give his darshan. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna has said, Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajati ante kalevaram. Whatever state of being you remember at the time of death, that state of being you attain without fail. Antakale cha mam eva smaran muktva kalevaram yaha prayati samad bhavam nati asti yatra shamshaya. He says that if you remember me at the time of death, you get me. So Bhishma Dev throughout his life has always done his duty. But at the end of his life, he is immovable. He can't to go and take darshan. Some of us, you know, if we know that now we are about to leave this body, we'll go to some holy place, we'll go to the Ganges, to the Yamuna, to Vrindavan maybe, and try to take darshan of the deity. But for Bhishma Dev, the Lord himself comes to give his darshan. And then it is mentioned that Bhishma Dev, while meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord, on the form of the Lord, gave up his body and went back to the spiritual world. So you get two sides, that on one side you have even the Pandavas. If you see their whole life, not very happy, always full of troubles. Even when they were young, Bhima was about to be poisoned, their house was set on fire, so many problems. But the end destination was the spiritual world. For Bhishma Dev, his whole life is full of duty and at the cost of sacrificing his pleasure, at the cost of sacrificing his own happiness. But then at the end of his life, he gets supreme destination. So Krishna, for devotees, sometimes there may be some painful situations in life, but then if we are happily accepting that, Tattenu kampam susamikshamano bhunjana evatma kritam vipakam ridvag vapur bhir vidadhan namaste jivetayo mukti padesa daya bhag. Lord Brahmaji in the 10th canto, he glorifies that Tattenu kampam susamikshamano. A devotee, if he patiently, with a grateful heart, suffers all the different reversals that may happen in his life, at the same time, in his heart, he is constantly trying to glorify the Lord, then such a person becomes rightful claimant of mukti. Mukti becomes his rightful claim. He does not have to endeavor hard for it. And we see that here. In text number 14 ahead, it is mentioned, Madhavaha Pandavas Chaiva Divyav Shankhau Pradadmatau. And there in the purport, Prabhupada mentions that if you see the previous verse, then when it is described that Bhishma Dev was blowing his conch, it is described, he blew his conch shell very loudly, Shankhau Dadmau Pratapavan. But for Arjuna and Krishna it is mentioned, Divyav Shankhau Pradadmatau. So for Bhishma Dev, the shank is an ordinary shank, but it is Pratapavan nevertheless. It's not an ordinary shank in that sense. But it's not mentioned that it was a Divya shank. It was a transcendental shank. But for Krishna and Arjuna, it is mentioned Divya shankhav. So even Krishna's conch shell, we can understand, you know, of course, he is the Supreme Lord. So Krishna is absolute. Whatever belongs to him is also transcendental. But it is Divya shankhav. It is not Divya shankhav. Singular form of shankha is shankha, and the dual form, when two shankhas are there, they are called as shankhav. So here it is mentioned that not only Krishna's shankh is divya, not only Krishna's shankh is transcendental, but Arjuna's shankh is also transcendental. It is also divya. So what we can understand from here is that when a devotee is trying to serve the Lord purely, is a pure devotee of the Lord, even he and his belongings, what to speak of the devotee, the pure devotee, even those things that belong to the pure devotee are also transcendental. Here we have Srila Prabhupada, and just in front of him we have the kartals, the symbols that were used by Prabhupada, and they are enshrined. We have a nice casing for them, and people who come to this temple, devotees who come, they have a darshan of those kartals. So those kartals belong to Prabhupada, who is a pure devotee of Lord Krishna. But then for us, even the kartals are worshipable. Why? Because they are also transcendental, belonging to a transcendental person. Here also, Divyav Shankhav Pradadmatav. Lord, how does he make his devotee transcendental? By his grace, in the case of Dhruva Maharaj we saw, you know, Brahma Mayena Kambuna, he touched his conch shell, by his grace he made them. By his instructions he can make, Arjun he made Divya, by his instructions he instructed him. So, the whole point is that the devotees throughout their lives, throughout their existence, they want to glorify the Lord. The activities of a devotee are, they want to glorify the Lord. And what does the Lord want to do? In reciprocation to that, the Lord also wants to glorify the devotees. This is what is going on, the reciprocation between devotees and the Lord. Prabhupada mentions in one purport that it's very natural. If there is some famous father, consider any famous man, and he gets his son, would not the father want his son to be more glorified, to become more famous than the father himself? We all have practical experience of this. If there's something in your father's life that he has not done, maybe he did not have access to good education, maybe he did not have access to certain things in life, and if it is possible for him to provide those same things to you, a facility for, you know, he's more than happy. He does not think, oh, I did not get those facilities, so why to give to my son? No, he wants, he is eager to do that. Similarly, Lord Krishna also, he wants his devotees to be glorified more than himself. So in the case of Bhishma Dev, in the case of Prabhupada, we see how they throughout their lives struggled to serve the Lord. And Lord in turn struggled or glorified Prabhupada and even Bhishma Dev. There is a small instance from which we can learn this example. One time, on a morning walk in Mauritius, Prabhupada and some of his disciples were going for a morning walk, and some disciples asked him, Prabhupada, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the supreme personality of Godhead himself. He is not different from Krishna. So when he preached, why did he preach only in India? We see from the life of Lord Chaitanya that he went to South India, but then, you know, more or less he is within the land called Bharatvarsha. He did not go much beyond the boundaries of present-day India. So the Supreme Lord, he could have preached throughout the world. I mean, he does not even have to go physically there. He can just instruct from here, and then his devotees, his representatives can travel, and he could get the credit of doing that. So this question was posed to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, he left something for me. He has left something for me so that I preach all over the world and then I get glorification. So Lord Chaitanya, he wants Srila Prabhupada to be glorified. That's why he left some of the preaching, major part in fact, to be done by Prabhupada, although he could himself have done that. So another example where Lord wants to glorify his devotees. Another way in which the Lord can make his devotee transcendental, another example is in the first canto of Bhagavatam, where Narad Muni is instructing Vyasadeva. And in the course of his instructions, he explains his past to Vyasadeva, his disciple. It's very interesting. If you read that section, he's instructing Vyasadeva, and suddenly in between, almost spontaneously, he starts speaking about his past life. You know, it's not that, you know, generally, Bhagavatam, if you see, a person asks a question and then the person responds. Here, as he's instructing philosophy, suddenly in between, Narad Muni, you know, remembers that I am instructing all this to you. But then how did I get all this mercy? How did I know all these things to instruct you? So he immediately shifts in a flashback to his past life. And then he tells how he was the son of a maid servant, not apparently having very high birth. But then he mentions that some devotees, some Bhakti Vedantas, they were traveling and they stayed in my home for 4 months. And then he mentions that I was very eager to serve them. I was not very frivolous. And then he says, Uchishta Lepan Anumodito Dvijay. This is how the verse starts. I didn't get the exact verse, but I remember. Uchishta Lepan Anumodito Dvijay. He mentions once. He does not mention several times. He says, once I took their remnants. Once I took the foodstuff that was left behind by those Bhakti Vedantas. And as soon as I took those remnants of those pure devotees, it is mentioned, my sins were gone. I got purified in my heart. And the very nature of the transcendentalist became attractive to me. Now I desired to have a life of a transcendentalist. I stopped desiring for being a materialist. Just at that moment, just by tasting the remnants of those Bhakti Vedantas just once. So again, this is an example of how these Bhakti Vedantas, what are they doing? They are just glorifying the Lord. They are traveling from place to place, preaching probably singing kirtan. And they stop at one place and there is the son of a maid servant, not having any training in some gurukul, not very sophisticated birth, maid servant. But then this person also, when he tastes the remnants of this Bhakti Vedantas, even once, what happens? All his sins are gone. In the case of Dhruv Maharaj, when we saw that when the conch shell was touched, it is mentioned, Dhruv became perfectly aware of Vedic conclusion and absolute truth and his relationship with other living entities. He was purified. All his contamination was destroyed. And in the case of Narad Muni, he didn't get direct darshan of the Lord, at least at this time. But what he did, he tasted the remnants of the pure devotees. And he also got the same results of his efforts. So for Dhruv Maharaj, it is direct association with the Lord. But for Narad Muni, it is the remnants of the pure devotees. And the results are the same. So the transcendentalist, the devotee of the Lord is also transcendental. Divyau Shankhau Pradadmato. And what to speak of the devotee, even what belongs to the pure devotee is also transcendental. We have the example of the Kartas. The next verse mentions Panchajanyam Rishikesho Devadatta Dhananjaya. Yeah, translation. Lord Krishna blew his conch shell called Panchajanya. Arjun blew his, the Devadatta. And Bhima, the voracious eater and performer of Herculean tasks, blew his terrific conch shell called Poundra. Then in the purport, Prabhupada mentions that Lord Krishna is called as Rishikesh here. Panchajanyam Rishikesho. So Rishikesha means he is the master of the senses of all living entities. Since he is the master, he is the Lord. He is on Pandava side. So if God is on somebody's side, how could the other party win? So that is the purport of this verse. That it is clearly mentioned that Pandavas are going to win by mentioning the name of Krishna as Rishikesh. It's already indicated in this verse that Krishna and Krishna's party is going to win. The Pandavas are going to win. We have this, you know, famous line that Prabhupada used to always say, Jayastu Panduputranam Yesham Pakshe Janardana. It's mentioned in the Mahabharata that Jayastu Panduputranam, all glories to the Putra, the sons of Pandu, Yesham Pakshe Janardana, on whose side is Lord Krishna. If you analyze the battle and the arrangement on the battlefield, on the side of Kauravas, you have 11 Akshahonis. Akshahoni is a measure of, you know, counting cavalry, infantrymen. There is a certain number to it, that one Akshahoni is, you know, so many thousand rats, so many lakhs of men on foot, so many soldiers on elephants and like that. There is a certain unit. So Vedic time unit of counting men, especially for a war, is Akshahoni. So the Kaurava side had 11 Akshahonis and the Pandava side had 7 Akshahonis. Even numerically, they're not, you know, it does not make sense that this party would win. The Kaurava side also had the special army of Lord Krishna from Dwarka. It is especially called Narayani Sena. They had all divine weapons, all those soldiers from Krishna's army in Dwarka. They were also on Kaurava side. We all know of that famous incident where Duryodhan wanted the army and then Arjun chose Krishna. So they are on this side. Who is there again on the Kaurava side? All those big, big generals. Dronacharya, who taught the Pandavas. Kripacharya, who taught the Pandavas. Bhishma, who taught the Pandavas. Just imagine you have students on one side and you have teachers on one side. Who's going to win? It's so much natural that the teachers are going to win. Even the Pandavas themselves, 5 Pandavas. And here Kauravas, how many? 100 Kauravas. So logically, it does not make any sense that the Kaurav side is ever going to lose. But in Rishi Kesho Pancha Janyam, Jayastu Pandu Putranam, Yesham Paksha Janardana. What is, like you have a weighing scale and then you put, you know, some heavy weight on this side and then something to be weighed on this side. And then you know that, you know, the weight, although it looks small, is, you know, usually heavier. Suppose I go to buy 5 kg of grains and there's a weighing scale. So the shopkeeper, he puts that 5 kg weight on one side. And it looks very small, is it not? Just a small weight. And here you have a big bag of grains weighing 5 kgs. So initially when you are pouring grains into that bag, you know, this part is down, although it looks small. So similarly, I was just thinking that, you know, you are just 5 Pandavas. Only 7 Akshavani Sena. But what is the weight here? It's Krishna. And if Krishna is there on this side, you have a big whole bag of grains. The Kauravas. 11 Akshavani Sena. But no, you know, this side goes down. So this is something that it is indicated by this verse. In the same verse, it is mentioned that Paundram Dadhmau Mahashankham Bhima Karma Vrikodaraha. Bhima Karma, and Prabhupada translates it as Bhima the voracious eater, that is Vrikodaraha, and performer of Herculean tasks, that is Bhima Karma. Karma is action, Bhima Karma is huge action, something that is impossible for other people to do. So one point that came to my mind was, you have Bhima, who is generally, you know, whenever we mention Bhima, the first thing that comes to our mind is that he was a voracious eater. He ate a lot. That is something that comes to our mind, is it not? We have that Pandava Nirjal Ekadashi, and that is the time also when Bhima is glorified, that somehow he had such voracious appetite that he could not control his tongue. But there's another thing that is applicable to Bhima, that he is Bhima Karma. He did Herculean tasks. We are just focusing on something that we can relate to, that he can eat a lot, he can enjoy a lot. But to justify his eating, he also did Herculean tasks. Who are the demons that he fought with? He fought with Jarasandha. Jarasandha was born from King Brihadrath, and then he did not have a son, King Brihadrath. And he went to a sage. Sage gave one mango. That mango was, you know, he had 2 queens, so he gave 2 mangoes to those 2, half a mango to each queen. And then the half body was produced. So then they thought, you know, not of any use. So they just threw it. Then there was a demoness called Jara, and she joined them, and that is how Jarasandha was born. So, you know, like we have people with divine origin. So this Jarasandha is of a demoniac origin. He's such a demoniac person. He fought with, Bhim fought with him, destroyed him. There's one mention of a demon called Jatasur. Jatasur, during their incognito life, he kidnapped Draupadi once, and then Bhim fought with him. We all know of that huge giant called Hidimba, who had to be fed every day by that whole village. And with him also, Bhim fought. He is the person who killed Duryodhan. He is the person who killed Dushasan. All these, they are big warriors. Dushasan was a very strong man. It is mentioned that he had strength of so many elephants. Duryodhan is such a strong man. He was almost, you know, equal to Bhim in strength. And he was very expert and agile also in wrestling. But all these people were destroyed by Bhima Karma Bhim. We just know of his one aspect, that he eats a lot. But we should also know that to justify his eating a lot, he also performs Herculean tasks. We always see these Western devotees, and sometimes we may not be able to understand, especially myself, you know, when I was new, I came to the temple and I saw one senior devotee and he had, you know, sunglasses. So I was thinking, you know, how come a renunciant has sunglasses? Could not understand that. Of course, then I later came to know that, you know, this devotee in India, you know, he's from the Western climate. So in the West, you don't have such strong sun. Sun is a very rare occurrence there. So they are not used to having this strong sun and strong sunlight, which is there in tropical India. That's why they wear sunglasses. Usually, you know, in the outside world, sunglasses are not worn by people in the renounced order. So one thing that came to my mind is, we just, you know, that is apparent to us. That is what we focus on. But then we don't see their services. When Prabhupada was there and when Prabhupada instructed them to do so much preaching, they are the ones who gave up their lives. They had, you know, so much sense gratification available to them. But rejecting all that, giving up all that, sacrificing all that, they have done so much preaching. They have pleased Prabhupada so much. In the 1971, when Prabhupada was in India and he wanted to preach, especially in Bombay, he got Shyam Sundar Prabhu, he got Tamal Krishna Goswami, he got Giriraj Maharaj. And he said, you know, you have to preach in Bombay. Bombay is the most important city of India. So we have to do something. So Shyam Sundar Prabhu was saying, you know, what to do? It's very difficult. Whenever we go and we try to deal with the local people, most of the times, we end up getting cheated. So Prabhupada told them, you all are Americans. You people are known for doing big things. What is your credit if you don't do big things? So, you know, agitated by that, Shyam Sundar Prabhu immediately arranged the Cross Maidan Festival in 1971. And we all know, so many leaders of present-day ISKCON came in touch with Prabhupada during this Cross Maidan Festival. Loknath Maharaj came that time. Radhanath Maharaj came that time. So many leaders, you know, it was because of that Cross Maidan Festival. So Prabhupada told him, you are an American, and you are known for doing big, big things. What is your credit if you are an American and you don't do big things in preaching also? So Bhima Karma Vrikodaraha. Let's not focus on only one side of a devotee. We should also see the services that these devotees have performed. So already past 8:30, I had some points, but then I think I should stop here because I don't want to delay you all. Stop here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki. So if somebody has any comments or corrections or suggestions, then please let me know. No questions. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki. Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki. Jai.
Hare Krishna. Devotees can remain in the temple hall. There will be kirtan till the Shayan Darshan Kirtan. Hare Krishna.
Okay. I just hope that I can please you all.